spending time with us and telling us what's going on in Detroit now, leading the charge against GM for the workers and victims of their products and the way they make their products.
You got it.
All right. Thank you so much. Is there anything you wanted to add or what resources that you wanted listeners to know about?
You can, there's more information available at the website www.asotrecol.org, and that's ASOTRECOL.org. And, there's also a Facebook page, Solidarity, with GM Hunger Strikers.
Great. And we'll link that to our KBOO, Portland
Thank
Labor
so
Radio
much.
Page too. Thank you so much, Frank. I can't wait to hear how it goes.
I lay down and try to rest, but Lord knows I'm too tired to sleep. Well, Lord, why don't you slow down your sending line this evening? Lord, have mercy. You can look at me, see I don't mind working. And trying to tell you people, you know I do my job.
This has been Labor Radio here on KBOO Portland. The time is 6:31, Monday, June 9th, 2014. Coming up next on Labor Radio, it's Prison Pipeline.
Tune in to KBOO for the 27th Annual Waterfront Blues Festival. KBOO will again broadcast the entire festival from noon to 10 p.m., July 3rd through the 6th. The broadcast will also be carried by various stations of Oregon Community Media for statewide coverage of this Oregon Food Bank Benefit Festival. Again, July 3rd through the 6th, noon to 10 p.m. each day here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh, Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Hello, and welcome to Prison Pipeline on KBOO 90.7 FM here in the Portland area. I'm your host, Peter Pincel, and tonight we're lucky enough to be sitting with Faribor Paxarecht, Director of the Oregon Youth Authority.
Faribor, thank you for sitting with us tonight. Why don't you take a second to introduce yourself?
Thank you, Peter. Again, Faribor Paxarecht from Oregon Youth Authority. Just a very brief background about myself. I grew up in Iran. I came here after high school to pursue higher education, and decided to stay primarily because I started a family. Actually, my youngest son just turned 27 here a couple of weeks ago. Worked for the state for about 24 years and have been with OYA just about 5.5. And I came to OYA on a temporary assignment just to help put some systems and processes in place. And why I decided to stay, well, two things. Number one is the new director at the time, Director Colette Peters, who's now the director of the Department of Corrections, asked me to stay, but also because I found deep meaning in working with the youth and knowing that I could actually have an influence in the lives of children who become adults, who become members of our community. And that was the primary reason that I stayed in OYA and ultimately now, for just about 2 years, have been the director.
Give us a big picture overview of OYA.
We serve juvenile delinquents between the ages of 12 and 25. So a youth who commits an offense or a crime between the ages of 12 and 18 come into our system based on the severity of the crime and based on the level of commitment by juvenile court. And there are two different youth population who come to OYA. One who commit less serious offenses, and they're committed to us through juvenile court. And of course, in Oregon, as you know, and many of your listeners, I'm sure, know, we have something called Measure 11, which was a ballot measure that passed, which defines minimum mandatory sentences for youth as early as 15 years of age. So they're basically being sentenced as an adult, even though they're not physically and mentally an adult. They are committed to us through the adult court. They're in the legal custody of the Department of Corrections, but in the physical custody of Oregon Youth Authority. They stay with us. You know, one of the positive things that happened after Measure 11 was passed, or in the process of passing Measure 11 and putting it into operation, was the age of youth who could stay in OYA was increased to 25, so that many of the youth who get the minimum sentence of 70 months could finish their time in the juvenile system and do not experience the adult system. So that was a positive thing that happened, after the measure was passed. Those youth who have longer sentences than their age 25, they transfer to Department of Corrections. But many of them actually finish their time with OYA and do not experience the adult system.
So, Faribors, what does a typical juvenile offender look like?
You know, first of all, I guess in answer to that question, I would say that every youth is unique and different. But if we were to speak in general terms, the majority of the youth who come to us are males, about 87%. The majority of are Caucasian, around 58%. 25% are Latino, 9% are African American, and 4% are Native American. And those statistics highlight a significant overrepresentation of minority youth in the system, which is a problem and a challenge that we all have to deal with. 70 to 80% of the youth who come to us are users of alcohol and drug. 60 to 70% of their parents are using alcohol or drugs. About 40 to 65% are diagnosed with mental health disorders, and that is a problem because, you know, many of the youth with mental health issues don't do real well in the criminal justice system. 30 to 35% are special education students. And 15 to 35% have been victims of sexual abuse. Many of these kids have been neglected and victimized, and in the process, they have created their own victims. And then this last statistic is pretty concerning. 10 to 14% of the youth who come to us are already a biological parent of a child. So, you know, children who have children.
Wow.
Could you tell us about one person you can think of in particular?
You know, there are many of those one persons that I would love to talk about, but I'll just share one story with you. There was this particular youth, a minority youth, who I knew, you know, through my interaction with him and going to the facility, and I actually attended his high school graduation. Some of his family members were at Department of Corrections. He had taken a turn for the worse after his high school graduation. Had gotten some consequences, you know, as a result of his actions. And it was his desire to actually transfer to DOC, to Department of Corrections. And he knew that if he assaulted staff, he would be transferred to the Department of Corrections. So that's what he did. He assaulted a few staff. And in the traditional way of doing things, some years ago, we would transfer him to DOC. Instead, we looked at his profile. We looked at the possibility of him being successful in DOC. And it was pretty clear that if he went to the Department of Corrections, we would lose him as a productive and contributing member of society. So we got his family involved. And with great credit to our facilities staff, who, you know, had been putting up with him and had been assaulted. Collectively, we made a decision to transfer him to a different facility. Some of his family members played a significant role in changing his mind. He went to a different facility, and within 6 months, he was a very high-ranking member of that cottage that he was living in. He transitioned to a transition camp in Eastern Oregon. We have a firefighting crew. He became the leader of that firefighting crew. And he was just released back to the community last week. He was actually, before he went back to the community, was mentoring other youth. A complete 180-degree turnaround. And he never had to experience the adult system. That was a huge success for him. And clearly a huge success for us. The one last thing that I want to add to that is the great work that our staff do in working. When we talk about youth, we're now talking about kids who are 20, 24 years of age. They're big kids. They're strong kids. They can hurt you. And, you know, to come to work every day and work in that environment takes a special individual, takes patience, and, you know, my hat's off to them. They do the work, I do the talking.
You mentioned that you took over an OIA 2 years ago. What would you say is the biggest thing you've accomplished since that time?
Well, frankly, I think, you know, there's nothing that I accomplish by myself. You know, we do this as an agency with our leadership team and, frankly, the employees who do the work on the front line, who carry the agency on their back. So they do the work. I take the credit for it. That's the way it generally works. But I think one of our biggest accomplishments has been to continue the work that had been started in OIA about 4 years ago, again, when Director Colette Peters started, and we put a significant emphasis on the use of data and research. So, if you ask me what is the most exciting thing that is happening in OIA today or has been happening, you know, within the past couple of years, I would tell you that it is what we call the youth reformation system. It is a system that uses data, predictive analytics, and research to determine that, in fact, the youth who come to us, it really has four components. The very first component is a forecasting component. What should be the capacity of this system based on what we know about the youth in Oregon? And I should tell you that Oregon is very unique. The Oregon juvenile justice system is very unique in a way that we have an electronic data system that connects OIA to all 36 counties in Oregon. No other state has that capability. And what that allows us to do is to have information and profile on any juvenile delinquent, whether they're served by the state or by the counties. And, you know, we have data back to mid-1980s. And it allows us, actually mid-1990s, it allows us to basically half a million records where we can go back and look at the profile of youth, who had been coming into the system, how have they done, in what environment. And that information is invaluable in determining how we deal with youth who are coming into the system today. So the very first component is a population forecast. Who should be coming into the system? Are we actually serving the right youth? The second piece is placement and treatment. Meaning, now that the youth is at our doorstep, what environment should they be placed in? What should be their length of stay? What treatment do they need to receive? How should we interact with them? The third component is a program evaluation continuum, meaning if we are spending X millions of dollars whether it is on gang intervention or aggression replacement therapy or any other kind of treatment, what are we getting back for that? Are we being effective in the type of programming that we are conducting with youth, or the money that we're spending in the communities to prevent crime or for transitioning youth back to the community? And the fourth piece and the final piece of this system is called community context. And it has two different components, one which kind of loops back to the forecasting piece. So the question is, what is feeding the system? If youth are coming into the system, what is the source of that transition into the juvenile justice system? Can we begin to identify that by sharing data with agencies, sister agencies, such as Department of Human Services, Oregon Health Authority, Oregon Employment Department, Department of Education, Housing and Community Services, Oregon State Police? And based on the level and the complexity of data that is available to us, we should be able to predict at a very early age youth who are on a path to end up in our system. And by providing that information back to, again, our sister agencies, we will enable them to do early intervention so that they would be diverting those youth, hopefully, from coming into our system. We are, unlike a private business, we want to run ourselves out of business. That would be my best accomplishment if I can contribute to that goal while I am in this position. So that's one piece of the community context. And the other piece is the transition piece. Many of the youth who come to us actually do pretty well with their programming, with their progress, but then if they're returned to communities that do not embrace them, to environment and neighborhoods that are not healthy for their development, they will fail. And our investment in them will be wasted. And most likely, they will commit another crime. And unfortunately, at that point, we will not see them again. They will go to the adult system. So those are the four components of the OYA Youth Reformation System. And there is one other element to that, and that is really a different way of interacting with youth. Research and data has shown that especially as youth are growing and developing, both physically and mentally, the way that we interact with them, the way that we deal with them, the way that we approach them, has a whole lot to do with how they turn out in the future. So it is so important that the environment that we create be a positive environment, because many of these youth, as they grow into their adulthood, may walk away from the current behavior. And that is the main difference between a juvenile offender and an adult offender. The brain is still developing up to age 25, so that period of time is so critical as to how we interact with these youth. How do we set them up for success? What kind of skills do we provide them to be successful in the community? And another big difference between a juvenile offender and an adult offender is, if you're incarcerated when you're 15 and you're with us, let's say, for 6 or 7 years, and now you're released back to the community, you have missed a big portion of your growing years. Meanwhile, things in the community have been progressing. Now iPhone 15 is out, versus iPhone 5 or 6. And, you missed all that. And you're walking back into a totally unfamiliar environment. You've never had an experience of having to rent a place and pay rent, or, go open a bank account. That is the main difference between juveniles and adults. Adults who are incarcerated have experienced life, responsibility, etc. So a big part of our responsibility and tasks becomes to give them the skills that they need. And even though we cannot exactly emulate the community environment, to do our best to make their transition successful, to help them gain the skill levels and the education that they need. And both of those things are pretty critical to the success in transition.
What else would you say impacts recidivism rates?
Education seems to be a pretty significant component of reducing recidivism. a study that was done in Texas about 15 years ago and was just updated 2 years ago, showed that with the adult offenders, while the general rate of recidivism in Texas was 60%, those with a high school diploma recidivated at 24%. Those with an associate degree recidivated at 13%, with a bachelor's degree at 5.6%, and with a master's degree at 0%. That's the impact of education on reducing recidivism. And yet, as a society, we have discontinued the Pell Grants for incarcerated adults.
Rather than someone getting the education, reducing their likelihood to recidivate,
right,
couldn't it be the individual who was less likely to recidivate is the one that seeks out the education in the first place?
Yes and no. I think, you know, what happens is that a lot of these youth come to us significantly behind grade. You know, you might have a 17-year-old that comes into our system with just a few credits. And somewhere along the line, they tap into a talent that they had that they were not aware of. They might have been really good in math, but they were not going to school to find that out. So, you know, in the process, it is pretty important for youth to understand what their talents and what their interests are. You know, if you're coming into the system with significant gang tendencies or significant criminal background, and all of a sudden you begin a path of education that takes you to a different place, then clearly that is not the case. But if you're coming into the system already doing well in school or interested in education and continue that, and that results in a lower recidivism, you could say, yes, you know, some of these youth actually were interested in education anyway, and that contributed to their lowering of recidivism. I think, you know, both cases could be found in the system, but what I've perceived and observed is that the majority of these youth who come into our system significantly are deficient in education, you know, as far as credits, et cetera. And, you know, when they're with us, they don't have a choice. They have to go to school. They can't skip class. They can't, you know, not go to school. And many of them actually find something that they really like, and they plug into that. And it doesn't necessarily have to be academic education. Vocational education is a significant contributor to reducing crime as well. The biggest challenge, frankly, is changing our mindset about how we approach youth. We are emerging from a traditional mindset of corrections into a new mindset of youth development. And when I say that, I don't want anyone to get the wrong impression that we're not going to hold youth accountable. Accountability is a cornerstone, the cornerstone of the work that we do and the system that we manage. But I think, you know, the challenge that we have, it's not just in OIA. I think it is at the community level, it's at the national level, it's at the global level. Are we able to widen our lens and see things from a broader perspective? Because if I look at the system that I am currently in charge of, which is the state system of juvenile justice, and I only look at this narrow slice of 12 to 25, this limited number of population that we are serving, I see a completely different picture than I see if I see myself connected to all the other elements of the community, state organizations, county organizations, federal organizations, and begin to think about what I need to do in this continuum in order to contribute to what we want the final outcome to be. So our biggest task in OYA is to return youth back to the community who can be productive and crime-free members of the community. Why do I say productive? Because a youth can be crime-free, but he can be addicted. He can be depressed. He can be suicidal. That is not success for us. So, you know, the biggest challenge is to change our mindset about how do we produce the best outcome that we can with the information that's available to us. And, you know, the most recent data and research that is emerging is telling us we have to pay very close attention, especially with youth, to their developmental process. Because if we simply focus on punishment, what we are actually doing is we are contributing to future victimization in the community. So we have to see the entire picture and act accordingly. And today we have the data and the research available to us to be able to do that.
So I'm glad you brought up data and research, because I recently read in the Willamette Week, the article "Spare the Jail, Spoil the Child," talked about a report by Chuck French where they were discussing the appropriate levels of accountability. They were saying that perhaps the level of juvenile incarceration is not high enough in Multnomah County. What do you say to that?
Well, you know, I'm really about the Willamette Week article. What I would say is it depends where we want to put our focus on. There are many things. I know Chuck French. We have a common goal. He is as much interested in, and, you know, that's his background. He's a former deputy DA, and he did his best to create a safe environment within his own sphere of influence, and I respect him for that. You know, we might disagree on a few points, but that doesn't mean that we have, you know, to sit across the table and shout at one another. You know, there are many common elements within the players who are actually trying to make the system better and trying to create an environment where youth can succeed, communities can be made safe, etc. So, you know, I would say that my preference would be for us to sit around the table. I think the article was premature because the white paper that Chuck French wrote is still in draft format. And, you know, they have asked for our input, and we've provided that. And, you know, we hope that the final report would reflect some of our recommendations that we've made. But, you know, we are glad to work with Chuck as well as any other players in the system. We can always improve. I mean, I believe that Oregon has a pretty well-functioning juvenile justice system. And, you know, we're hearing that nationally. But we can always improve, and we welcome feedback from Chuck French or any other individual who wants to help us with improving the system.
There's been a reduction in crime rates since the mid-90s for right. the juvenile population. Is that the consequence of great work by OYA?
I don't think so. I don't think we can take credit for either a reduction in crime rate or take a hit for an increase in crime rate. We are such a small slice of the system, and I think we are a contributor to, success of youth who come to us, and naturally, you know, there are many different variables that helps them succeed or fail. Frankly, I don't know if there is an answer about why the crime rate has dropped. There is a perspective that says because of longer sentences, because of Measure 11, we are seeing this reduction. There is a different perspective that says in states that don't have minimum mandatory sentences for juveniles, we've seen the same reduction or perhaps even more. So I'm not sure exactly. You know, then there are other hypotheses that perhaps, you know, video games and computer technology has contributed to youth being off the streets and, you know, acting out their aggression through, you know, video technology. Who knows what the answer is? But clearly, I'm delighted that the rate has dropped.
Do you have any last words for the audience?
Thank you, Peter, for having me on the program. You know, the last word for the audience is we need to work together to create the outcomes that we want for our communities. I think there are too much separation. There are too much fighting, whether, you know, it is in our Congress or at the local level. We need to set an example of how we can work together to achieve the right outcomes. You know, these kids who come to us are our kids. They're your kids, they're my kids, they're our kids. And we need to deal with them as they're developing, as their brain is developing and they're, you know, completing this adolescent journey to transition into adulthood. We need to work together to create the best path for them so that we do not allow them or empower them to create future victims. The work that we do is about reducing victimization and creating safer communities. And, you know, I thank you for helping us with that journey. We can't do it without you.
Thank you, Faerborst. That's all for now. You've been listening to Faerborst Paxarescht, Director of Oregon Youth Authority on Prison Pipeline. Visit us online at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. If you like us on Facebook. Tune in next week to hear Stephanie Guy's show on the book I Am Troy Davis. I'm Peter Pincel. Have a great night.
Understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor and broadcast live from the 2014 Safeway Waterfront Blues Festival. The 27th annual festival will take place July 3rd through the 6th, 2014, at Tom McCall Waterfront Park. It will feature Greg Allman, Los Lobos, Lee Fields, and The Expressions among the 100-plus acts that will perform over the four-day festival. The 27th annual Waterfront Blues Festival will benefit the Oregon Food Bank.